All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We have a really, really interesting show today. I'm really happy about this show. Towards the back end of the show, we're going to be running the first in a new series and a continuing series of the Basics bus tours that rolled through the South and now most recently was in New York and the surrounding area. And we're going to be bringing an interview I did from that New York leg of the tour. But opening the show up, I am really pleased to bring back to the show Roger Genver Smith. And we're going to be talking with Roger about his new work, Rodney King. And this is Roger's a cat whose work has always, always touched something in me that very few other artists manage to do. And I was just talking with him a minute ago about it seems to reach in and grab the humanity and bring it out to you and lay it before you and allows you to actually get a very different perspective on some really critical things. And it's all kinds of people, historical figures, people who are there by choice, people who are there by accident. And in this play in particular, I was just really moved by the fact that he decided to do a play about Rodney King. Roger, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Michael. Good morning.
Yeah. Let's jump into this. I was moved that you decided to do something about Rodney King because in the last, this being the 20th anniversary this year, and especially around the time of the LA Rebellion, everybody's attention was focused up around the rebellion, but also around Rodney King. And one of the things that, you did with this, when you brought out this point about Rodney King, you actually went in and you dealt with the person, not with the iconic figure, not with the, you dealt with the person. What did you see in Rodney King that made you want to do this work about him?
Well, I think I was compelled by my extraordinary sense of loss when I heard that he had passed on Father's Day this year. And I needed to know where that grief came from. Why did it matter to me so deeply that this man had been lost to us when I had never met him? I had talked about him for 20 years. I had referenced him in many plays inside the Creole Mafia with Mark Broyard and my collaboration with Mark Anthony Thompson, Christopher Columbus 1992, in which Columbus actually is still among us as a lounge singer and sings a song called Do the Rodney King. But I didn't know the man. I hadn't accessed the spirit of the man. And in diving into the archives and trying to exhume the humanity of someone who had become a symbol has been an extraordinarily moving process, and it's been a challenging one as well to take that on stage every night and to kind of improvise, if you will, a journey, a very difficult journey into the psyche of a man and also the psyche of a nation, of a city at war with itself.
It's really interesting. Let's talk, before we get into the rest of the stuff I got around the content of it, let's talk about that point you made about taking this story to the stage every night and the improvisational aspect of this, because it's real. I thought it was really interesting. I don't know, there's points in the play where you make a statement and then your voice drops very low and it becomes, a very almost a silent, but it adds a dreamlike, it adds a nebulous character to the whole thing. But then it comes back up at exactly the point where you need to know it. And you can see a lot of what I took as being, and maybe it wasn't intentional, but to me it became that. It was sort of a way that you presented this kind of confusion on Rodney King's part, confusion, not knowing where he was at, what had happened to the Rodney King that existed pre-1992 and where is the one that exists in 2012?
Well, it's a personal confusion. It's a personal schizophrenia. But it's also a social one. It's one of the society. We are in that swimming pool with Rodney King. We are afloat. We go underwater. We try to catch our breath. We try to revive ourselves. Sometimes people come to the rescue. Sometimes they don't. I'd like to think that this piece is floating in that giant pool called America, in which so many have drowned, but so many have survived. And it's a really compelling process for me as an artist, aspiring to what I think the great musicians have already achieved in terms of improvisation. I go to see, for example, Branford Marsalis play the same old standards night after night after night, but imbuing them with something new, something fresh, something startling, something funny, something outrageous. And this is the type of theater that I've been trying to do for the last 20 years. Jazz theater, if you will.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Roger Genver Smith, writer, actor, playwright, and we're talking about his new work, Rodney King. Now, let me ask you this, because in a lot of your work, you talk about iconic figures in history, and you bring out things both it's never limited. It's not sort of a get up and just repeat what they say, but you really dig into their being, into their humanity, into the contradictions inside them. A lot of those figures are actually they're iconic figures in history, partly because of choice. Very few because of accident, in a certain sense. You know, it's like, you know, like if you look at Huey, you know, Huey was choice. He chose to get up, and in a way, what happened to him as he went along, he was caught up in something that was very big, and he was not clear how to deal with it. And there's a lot of that happens to a lot of people. But for Rodney King, all he did, which you portray very well, all he did was he went out, he got drunk, he went out, he drove, he did whatever, got stopped. And then the big thing that he did is that he lived. And by accident, someone caught him being beaten, and he, by accident, he lived through, as you described, which I thought was a really great thing to bring out of this, the baddest ass whooping in history, you know, which is true. You know, people, you know, you think about that, it's really true. But Rodney survived, and that became sort of the you know, you are dealing with a figure now that's like that, who's in this place in history, not by will, not by choice, but by accident.
Yeah, you know, Rodney was with two friends on the night of March 2nd, which became the night of March the 3rd, 1991. They watched a ball game. They had a few drinks. He went out on the road in a white Hyundai. And, you know, he was pulled over eventually. And he pulled over in front of an apartment complex because, as he said, many years later, he knew that there would be somebody there who would be able to witness whatever went down. And indeed, somebody did bear witness, George Holliday, who had a new video camera, which at that time was fairly advanced technology. And Rodney King became, in effect, the first reality TV star.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing you bring up too, and you bring it up in a way that's very powerful, you bring up a whole litany of other people, you know, that have been oppressed and have been murdered by the police. You bring up a litany of people like, you know, people like Latasha Harlins. You bring up all these people. You bring up the systematic, because this is the other thing that comes out very powerful in your play. On the one hand is the accidental character of Rodney King being where he is, but then it's also, it's within the context of very systematic oppression that has been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years. Very powerful mix there. Was that hard to work with?
Oh, sure. It's always hard to work with when you're working with tragedy. The confrontation of Latasha Harlins was not actually with the LAPD. It was with a woman by the name of Sun Jadu, who was a proprietor of a convenience store in central Los Angeles, who shot 15-year-old Latasha Harlins in the back, and she died immediately. My thoughts last night on stage went to the beautiful, young, and so talented Gabby Douglas, who represented our country in London at the Olympics. And is bringing home gold. And you wonder what the potential of Latasha Harlins might have been. And we know that the woman who took her life away was sentenced only to 2 years probation and 500 hours of community service. And we wonder, what about the 500 years of free community service that we have given this country. And I'm so proud of Gabby Douglas.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Roger Genver Smith, writer, actor, playwright, artist extraordinaire in my mind, actually. And we're talking about his new work, Rodney King. But let me ask you this. You know, one of the things that, you know, one of the things that really struck me is there's people forget, you know, Rodney King, again, this question of choice with Rodney King, you know, Rodney King, and he came out, we used to do this concert called Art Speaks. And in the first couple of events, it was the first three, maybe it was around police brutality. And Rodney King came to one of the biggest ones we had at the Vision. And he just came to show up. And even as you talk to him, you know, he was still very, very confused about what happened and why. And I realized as I was, you know, talking and doing shows and writing about the 20th anniversary of the rebellion and, you know, and I think the rebellion was righteous and just. But and I think actually what happened to Rodney, though, is Rodney never even had a chance to even think about that in the sense of because everything that happened to him, he was 26 years old, a kid. He was just a kid. You know, you think about these what's happening there. And he gets thrust into that stage. And then he's blamed for everything. And I thought you really got into that in the play in a way that was just snapped your head and took you to a whole different spot when you started talking about the victims of what happened in 92. And you start talking about how this was not – they were not victims of people's righteous anger. They were actually – a lot of it was sort of twisted and turned to make it seem like it was all this. But Rodney became the cause of all this. And you can imagine that weighing down on somebody incredibly difficult.
You know, it's interesting playing Huey Newton and playing Rodney King or alluding to Rodney King. Both Californians, both died at the age of 47 and both thrust into international prominence at about the same age. Huey Newton, obviously by choice, having co-founded the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense in 1966 with Bobby Seale, and Rodney King having that crazy confrontation with Coon, Pow, Brasino, and Wind. That's Coon, Pow, Brasino, and Wind. He was given a script to read on May Day 1992 by his lawyers. He threw the script away, and he spoke from his heart. And I think he delivered one of the great speeches in American history. I think it's right up there with that other king. When he said, "Can we get along?" It's a simple question. But then he went on to say, you know, that we've got to quit. It's not right. Look at the security guard shot down on the ground. These people will never go home to their families again. We're all stuck here for a while. We've got to work it out. And these are questions, these are issues, which obviously have yet to be addressed. We look at the recent events in Aurora, Colorado, the recent events in Anaheim, California, where brutality, violence, continue to direct our country. And as Rodney would say, beautifully, I think, we've got to quit. And Rodney King, in a sense, was an invention. March 3rd, 1991 was the last night, essentially, that he was Glenn King. That's what his comrades called him. That's what his family called him, Glenn. Rodney Glenn King, but they always called him by his middle name. Only his mother addressed him by Rodney if he was in trouble. He said that he never went to school to learn how to be Rodney King. And I think that that's quite telling. And we're all, in essence, in conflict with different selves. Both individually and, I think, as a nation.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Roger Genver Smith, writer, actor, playwright, and we're talking about his new work, Rodney King. You know, one thing I'd have to say, though, too, is that, like I said, there's a difference between the violence that happened to Rodney. There's a difference between that, and there's a difference between the violence that happened when the Latinos were killed in Anaheim recently. You know, when all these killings happened, and even frankly in Aurora, Colorado, there's a difference between that kind of violence and the kind of what erupted in the rebellion. And I thought that was one of the things they were trying to do, was seize on Rodney King and push him out there to say, look, you know, and I'm sure what went down too is that you're responsible for this. It's because of what happened to you. They never say it's because of what those four cops and the whole LAPD did, and every cop around the country got behind them. You know,
they're called the Rodney King riots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I always go out of my way to remind people that Rodney King didn't riot. And Rodney King was not the impetus for the riots. It were the officers who brutalized him. Kuhn, Powell, Brasino, and Wind.
Mm-hmm. And actually it reminded me of something.
Kuhn, Powell, Brasino, and Wind.
And it reminded me of something actually too, because it's sort of, you know, again, when people rebel against injustice, in my mind, it's a righteous thing. And I think, you know, what Rodney was getting hit with was like, you're responsible for loss of life, loss of property, loss of whatever, all this stuff, as opposed to, as you're saying, the cops, the system, whatever. But there's also something that happened that, you know, Rodney, I don't know, it was sort of, you know, very powerful moments in what happened with Rodney King, and yet he's, you know, there's things that happened as he went along, and I saw him speak at USC during the LA Times Book Festival, and it was, you know, he still seemed to be very confused about the situation. He still seemed to be trying to find one way to figure this out, to figure out what happened. He talked about, well, cops still stop me like crazy, then they party with me. I look back and look at things, and I try to figure out what's happening, and he just seemed very lost, except on one moment when he said. And he compared himself, and he didn't do it on purpose. He just compared himself in a certain sense. They asked him about Trayvon Martin, and he said something that really I found very moving. He said, look, I heard the 9/11 tape. I heard the cry. I knew it belonged to Trayvon, and this is why. Because it's the same cry I made. It's the cry you make when you know you're going to die. You know, a very, very moving moment. And I kept thinking that this is what happened to Rodney King.
But he also said that if he heard that cry and it came from Zimmerman, he would have the same feeling. And I think that that's the humanity of Rodney King as well. But, you know, there is no linear thought process in Rodney King, as there isn't any linear thought process in many of us. But we have to remember that the man was brain damaged. The man had his eye, you know, pumped into his brain. He had 11 fractures. He underwent a 5-hour surgery. He was taken not to the hospital from the scene of the beating, but to the police station, where he was paraded as a kind of trophy, just like that deer in the great film The Deer Hunter that's strapped on top of the car. So he said that he faced death that night. It was 45 minutes of hell, and he didn't think that he would survive. But he did, and I think that he has left us a very compelling message. And I can only hope that I do it justice in this new piece, which is entitled Rodney King.
Well, I certainly think you do it justice, and I'd have to say, too, and just to throw in there, you know, one of the things that happened with Rodney King from the moment he was targeted and beaten, the dehumanization. And it continued, you know, when he became and this righteous rebellion, and then he became sort of this icon of the other side, putting him out there as sort of the one who caused suffering as opposed to their system, as we were saying. But he became all this. And there's a thing there where they robbed him of his humanity when they beat him. They tried to beat him to death. They robbed him of his humanity when they made him into this icon that he wasn't. And then other people robbed him of it too when they continued all the way up through the end of his life. The struggle over, is he a hero? Is he a victim? You know, and there's really a question there. He was Rodney King. He was a human being that was thrust into the stage of history in a way that he never expected and didn't want, and then had to deal with the repercussions of that the rest of his life. And I thought you did a really wonderful job in capturing that humanity. So
thank you. Thanks for being there.
Roger, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
That's it, Roger. We got to run because we got a tight show after this. So
keep running.
Okay, take care, man, and great show. All right, you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Roger Genver Smith, actor, writer, playwright, and we've been talking with him about his new piece, Rodney King, which tells the story of the terrible consequences that befall Rodney King simply for being a black man in America at the wrong time and in the wrong spot, which is, frankly, in America, every time and every spot. We're going to take a quick break now, and when we come back, we will be listening to the beginning of a new series I'm doing on the Basics Bus Tour. That's a tour that's going around the country to many different places, introducing the revolutionary work and vision of Bob Avakian to people who might not ever get a chance to hear or encounter that work, and who are living in a world that they know is a horror. And this tour is bringing in the message that it doesn't have to be this way, and the work and leadership of Bob Avakian has everything to do with that simple fact. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss that. Welcome back. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. Over the last couple of months, I've been part of the Basics Bus Tour as it rolled through the South in late May, and most recently, I joined the third leg of the tour covering parts of New York City and some of the surrounding areas in the Northeast. The Basics Bus Tour is on a mission to bring the revolutionary work and vision of Bob Avakian out to places where people don't normally have access to it, and in doing so, helping to bring forward a nationwide movement for revolution. As a revolutionary journalist, I spent my time on a tour talking with the people we met about their lives, their hopes, and their dreams. We dug into the deep questions of how to change things and what kind of world we could have and why the leadership of Bob Avakian is so necessary in order for this to happen. I'm developing a series based on the stories of the people I met during the tour, and over the last few weeks, I've been airing the voices from Sanford, Florida. While I intend to air a couple more segments from the southern leg of the tour, I wanted to sneak in a preview of what happened on the New York Northeast leg of the tour. Keep listening for the whole series in the weeks to come. For more on the Basics Bus Tour, go to basicsbustour.tumblr.com. That's Basics Bus Tour, all one word, .tumblr, that's tumblr.com. I first met Nikki at a Harlem park where the Basics Bus Tour volunteers were having a send-off breakfast on the first day of the New York City and outlying areas leg of the tour. Nikki's a middle-aged black woman. She's quiet and reserved. As volunteers chowed down on all kinds of food, including juice, cereal, homemade corn muffins with sausage, sandwiches, and tons of fruit, one of the local activists explained to us where this all came from. He told us that the bus tour tables had been set up on street corners like 125th in Amsterdam, and that as people learned about the tour and its purpose, many of them dug deep into their pockets to drop money into the giant donation jar on the table. Now, these were people from the surrounding projects, and they generally don't have a whole lot of extra anything to toss around loosely. But this tour touched their hearts and their brains, and people dug deeply into pockets that sometimes had little more than holes in them. It's an area where young black men are constantly under threat from the police, and where the People's Neighborhood Patrols have been active for a while. Some people, including young people, took smaller donation jars out to their friends, churches, tenants' associations, schools, and buildings, and then fed what they collected into the larger jar. If people didn't have any spare money, they pulled out food from their cupboards to support the tour. All told, approximately $450 was collected in a neighborhood where people often have to decide which meal they're going to have to sacrifice in order to stretch the food supplies through to the end of the month. They were eager to be part of this movement for revolution in whatever way they could. As the brother continued to tell stories about taking the tour out to the people, I glanced over in Nikki's direction. She was listening hard. Sometimes she rubbed the corner of her eye, and other times a broad smile lit up her face. I went over to talk with Nikki, and she told me that she had embraced the tour from the moment she heard about it. She also told me that she had gotten Bob Avakian's latest book, Basics, and would love to talk with me about her thoughts on all this. We arranged to talk at our home a couple of days later. Nikki lives in the Bronx. It's the northernmost borough of New York City, and it's one of those places that all kinds of people know about, and some even work in the area or drive through on the highways that slice across the Bronx as they head out to someplace else. It's renowned as the birthplace of hip-hop and a center of Latin jazz, but truth is, very few people purposely make their way to most of the neighborhoods in the Bronx for fun. More than 1.4 million people live there. 53.5% of the people who live in the Bronx are Puerto Rican or Dominican, while 30.1% are African American or black people from the Caribbean. Over the last couple of decades, a number of African immigrants have also moved to the area. The Bronx is the borough with the lowest number and percentage of white people living in it. And while the Bronx has a few better-off neighborhoods, it also has some of the poorest neighborhoods in the U.S. 28% of the families and 30.7% of the population live below the poverty line, including 41.5% of those under age 18 and 21.3% of those 65 or older. For many decades at the end of the 1900s, the Bronx was a concentration of abandoned buildings and arson fires that burnt them down. As I got off the bus in Nikki's neighborhood and headed up the block to her street, I had to pass by two cop cars, one on each side of the street. They eyed me for a while but didn't interfere. By the time I got to the intersection with Nikki's street, one of the cop cars was crawling up the hill behind me. I only knew this because just as I got to the intersection, I heard a loud, gravelly voice yelling out, "Police!" Three old men were sitting on a bench just outside of a neighborhood playground. They explained that they were old friends who now saw themselves as watchers. They sat on that bench all day, every day, and knew everyone in the hood and everything that happens. As we talked, they shouted out birthday greetings to passersby, asked about health problems, and tossed around enough sharp jokes and comments to make your head spin. They said that they watch out for the people, and explained that yelling out about the police was just so no one would be taken by surprise. They told me that for many in the neighborhood, just being alive made them a suspect and a target for the police. They pointed out to me that in some neighborhoods in the U.S., their little bench would be inside the playground instead of outside of it. They called my attention to a sign that barred any adult not in the company of a child from entering the playground. They also pointed out that the listed rules of the park pretty much ruled out most things that kids do for fun in a park. I asked the watchers which way I had to go to reach Nikki's building. They pointed down a street with identical light brown or off-white brick apartment buildings, the walls often stained with dark smears that come from decades of human sweat, tears, laughter, and suffering. A poetic symmetry of black metal fire escapes forming cascading Z's down the front walls of all the buildings drew me into the neighborhood. As I made my way into Nikki's building, concerned neighbors took careful note. Nikki greeted me warmly, and we began to talk. I asked her about life in the Bronx.
Actually, I've lived here my whole life, since about the age of 4. And living in the Bronx is a struggle. It's always been a struggle. It's been a struggle for my mother and my father who raised me. Having a job where I still can't have enough to make ends meet. I've been forced to work 2 jobs and even 7 days a week where I still can't seem to get ahead. I've raised 4 children right here in this apartment. There has been times where I've had to rely on public assistance with my jobs. I have children that have gone to college. And even today, I still struggle with a job. Just seems like no matter what I do, I just can't get ahead.
Nikki had told me about her sons and how she had spent so much of her life worrying about their safety in the neighborhood. I asked her to tell me what it was like to raise her sons in the Bronx.
I think, just like for me, fear, always fear. Our children, as they get older, I have 2 of my sons that well, actually all three of my sons that have been stopped by police, not doing anything. I've tried to be a mother that asked for a curfew that really didn't work, but that's because I fear that what will happen to them out in these streets, you know? My oldest son actually did 7 years for something that he didn't do. He was accused of 2 cab driver robberies. Basically, no proof at all, but he was sent to prison for 7 to 14 years. And at that time, my son was into the rap business. He had a $90,000 contract signed with Def Jam Entertainment. And still, that didn't matter to these people. They accused him of robbing 1 cab driver for $100 in a ring and says that he smokes a cigarette in the back of the cab. My son never smoked a cigarette a day in his life. But none of that mattered. I have a handicapped son who has been arrested and thrown up against the wall for no reason at all. He's gone to visit neighbors in the project, maybe at a party. He was arrested for trespassing. The officer said, "Do you live here?" "No, I'm just visiting. There's a party here." They hauled him off to jail. You know, so it's, we've basically, as a mother, I've had to live in fear. I feel lucky and to some degree that my children have only just been arrested, because a lot of other mothers have actually lost their sons' lives. Mm-hmm. So to that degree, I feel sort of blessed. Mm-hmm. But I still don't know, you know, will that day ever come? You know, that's what it's like living here in the Bronx.
It was hard to think of Nikki as living in fear. Although I had only met her a couple of days earlier, she seemed to be determined and really inspired by the Basics bus tour and the movement for revolution it's bringing forward and that she is now a part of. I asked her what drew her to the tour and the revolution.
I believe it happened maybe about a month ago. I was on 125th Street in Marcus Garvey Park, and some gentlemen came by with this big poster, and they were talking about the bus tour, and they asked me if I'd like to write something on the billboard, and I did. And I left my number and my email with them. And I would say maybe about a week or so later, I got a call from Ruth. And she said to me, "You know, your number and your email was left. What would you be willing to do, you know, to help us in this revolution, in this movement?" And I was like, "What do you need me to do?" You know, I've basically, my whole life has been devoted toward making change, you know, for the better of people, even with, as being a mom and also as an educator in the school system. I just think that this world is just so upside down, and people only do better when they know better. I mean, it doesn't seem fair to me that one household has food to throw away and another barely has food at all. I don't like the idea of one particular group of people being able to determine what I eat, where I live, what type of education I'll have, you know. And it goes back to the basic book, you know, that one particular race of people defines the lives of others, and even before our children are born. You know, they're doomed before they ever get here. And that really bothers me.
Nikki's copy of Basics was on the coffee table. I reached for it and read her the quote she was referring to. It says, "No more generations of our youth here and all around the world whose life is over, whose fate has been sealed, who have been condemned to an early death or a life of misery and brutality, whom the system has destined for oppression and oblivion, even before they are born. I say no more of that." I asked her what she found so striking about that quote.
What I found about that quote striking is that I think that for so long that we have learned to become comfortable with the abuse that we suffer on a daily basis. And when we say no more, to me, it means that in our hearts and our souls, that we're not going to take this anymore. You know, it's not like a smoke screen that we don't realize what's happening to us and what you're doing to us. And we have to fight back. You know, we just can't just stay laid down and do nothing. You know, that, and that's why that's really important to me. I was a part of the Stop and Frisk Silent March, and that was really powerful. Here you had, you know, these hundreds of people, different organizations, walking down this one street all together until we got to the mayor's house. But no one said a word. But yet you knew why we were there. And I think that's powerful. Sometimes, you know, I have to go back to maybe Martin Luther King. Like, fighting and not being able to win, you know, as far as armies and guns and rifles, sometimes no words are just as powerful as words. And I felt really good about being there. We had our signs, no more stop and frisk, and other things about Trayvon Martin and other youngsters that have been killed in this city and around the world. And it just sent a powerful message that, you know, we don't have to fight you with our fists and guns for you to understand what we're trying to say. And that was very powerful for me.
Nikki had mentioned how deeply impacted she was when she heard about the murder of Trayvon Martin. It was personal, deeply personal.
Well, to be honest, because it's a typical thing here in our city, I went, another mother's child. You know, like, when does it end? There's been so many. I mean, it's almost like I'm losing count. And it touches me because it makes me look at reality and say, will it be my son tomorrow? I can't imagine what it's like to lose a child, but I know that living where I live, that it's a possibility that that day may come for me.
I asked if she had been involved in any of the struggles demanding justice for the young Black and Latino men who have been murdered by the police in New York City. Nikki talked about the horror of these murders and the fact that the police always seem to get away with them. She also pointed out that even if they don't kill these young men physically, they kill them in other ways, branding them for life with a criminal label that means they live in a shadow world with no rights and few opportunities to hack out a living.
To me, they always get away with it. I mean, I've not really ever heard of any case where they've, you know, wrongfully killed our children or imprisoned them or even beat them where they haven't gotten away with it. Like I said, my son did 7 years for something that he didn't do. And he came out. He was supposed to be on 7 years of probation. But because my son is not the monster that they thought he was, they lessened his parole. He was done in 3 years. He's a musician, and he chose to travel the world and to share his talent. And I believe my son went over to Europe, and he was scheduled to have a concert there. And as soon as he got off, you know, the plane or whatever, he was detained, never allowed to make it to his concert, because when they looked at, you know, his papers and so forth, they went into the computer and they says, we see that you have a record. So he spent, I believe it was like 4 days in this detaining center, and then put back on the plane and, you know, like, get him out of here. And this is a label that many of our young adults, as well as old ones, you know, you steal a loaf of bread because you're hungry, because you're starving, you have a family to feed. And they send you to prison for stealing a loaf of bread in a place where they tell you it's rehabilitation for you. So, I mean, doesn't that count for something? Then you walk outside those doors, and your family hasn't gone away. You still have a family to feed. And you try to do things the right way. You go and you apply for a job. But you've been labeled and you've been stamped. So they'll say, no, sorry, we don't have work for you. You're an ex-con. Mm-hmm. So what do you do? Well, I mean, where do you turn to? You go to public assistance and you've got five kids to feed, but they decide that you only need $300 to feed your family of five or six people. So you get what we have or you starve to death. And that's not the way this system should be.
I talked with Nikki about the nature of the system and how Bob Avakian has pointed out that this system can't even guarantee people something as basic as the right to eat. We went back and forth for a little bit, parsing out what it means to talk about the system, and that the very nature of this capital system is what makes the system do what it does to people. It can't do anything else. Nikki moved forward and talked about this and what she has learned from reading Basics.
It's to me, it's just not human. A system that only cares about wealth and power and is willing to just annihilate human life to get it. To me, that's not a system. I don't even know what to call it. You know, I mean, what happens to everyone else that's in need? I mean, how do you have so much hate for other people that you don't care if they breathe, if they eat, if they die, if they live? I know there's a better way. Mm-hmm. I know there is. And I put a lot of faith into this Basics book because overall what it tells me is that we have to be united. You know, we have to come together. But a lot of times we don't know what's being done to us. And this is why I think the Basic Bus Tour is a wonderful thing, because it goes around and it educates people and it gets them to see what exactly this system is doing. I think that it's an awesome book. I think that so far what I've read, and like I was telling you, I'm just so into other things right now in school, but every chance I get, I pick it up. It's knowledgeable. It shows me some of the things that are being done to me that I couldn't maybe see before, you know, because it's done in a way that the system does things in a way that it like blinds you. You know, you think because if you're on public assistance, they pay your rent, or, you know, they give you a couple of food stamps, you know, your life is great. But why can't you live where they live? Why do we have to have food stamps? Why don't people just be able to have enough money to go out and to buy food? You understand what I'm saying? So it opens my eyes to some things that I was never able to see before. And I think that's the wonderful thing about this book. One piece that really stuck with me is that when you talk about public assistance, you know, everything's on the computer now, you know, and there are millions of people on public assistance and depend on that to survive. That's how they eat. And this system is able to just press a button and say, millions of you will just starve. I mean, that's not human.
I talked with Nikki about two of the quotes that are also being featured on this leg of the tour, and in fact were being taken out to all kinds of people all over the city and all over the country. American lives are not more important than other people's lives, and internationalism, the whole world comes first. I asked Nikki if she had thought about these quotes and what they meant to her.
Yes, what it means to me, it just seems like America is just a greedy place, you know, and they go places and they take people's lands and they put them in situations where they can't do for themselves, you know, and have to be dependent on them. No one person anywhere is more important than anyone else. We're all human beings, and we all deserve to be treated with the same respect, the same dignity, and no one should have more than another. There's no reason why those children over in those third world countries should, you know, you should see their ribs and they're starving because of mere medications and no food, you know, no family. It's just not right.
I started to tell Nikki about the children being worked to death in the Congolese mines in order to get coltan, one of the very key ingredients for cell phones. Nikki interrupted me right away.
Absolutely. They're working sun up to sundown, and whatever they're working for, they still don't have adequate food.
Well, they're working to get this mineral called coltan that goes into producing cell phones.
Isn't it something? Oh, my God. It's horrible. You know, and then I think about the ones, you've got 9 and 10-year-old girls in places, they're prostituting their bodies just to eat. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, like, it's unreal. It's just unreal.
I wanted to read Nikki a quote from Basics, but when I picked her book up and began to look for that quote, I noticed that a number of the pages in the book were dog-eared, and certain quotes were highlighted in yellow. I found one quote that Nikki said was one of her favorites.
Well, let's talk about this one. This is kind of interesting. You have, is this the one you have earmarked here? The one about, in a world marked by profound class division, social inequality, to talk about democracy without talking about the class nature of that democracy and which class it serves is meaningless and worse. So long as society is divided into classes, there can be no democracy for all. One class or another will rule and it will uphold and promote that kind of democracy which serves its interests and goals. The question is which class will rule and whether its rule and its system of democracy will serve the continuation of the eventual abolition of class divisions and the corresponding relations of exploitation, oppression, and inequality. Now you have that highlighted.
I think what that stood out for me, I just never really understood why are we separated? You know, why are you the poor class, the middle class, the wealthy class? Why don't we all have equal? And money seems to take preference over human life. So those who are richer and have more will always be in the predicament to keep us oppressed and keep us from not reaching that same level. And is that democracy? Is that what democracy is supposed to be about? 'Cause I don't think so. I mean, like, democracy, like, we're all supposed to be a team, you know, and decide things together. Things are supposed to be divided up equally. I have a say, I have a right, you have a right. But in this country and around the world, we don't have a right. We have no rights. There is no democracy. You're not rich, you have no voice.
When Nikki talked about women and young girls being forced into prostitution and sexual slavery around the world, I wanted to hear what she thought about one of the quotes from Avakian on the oppression of women. I read the quote to Nikki.
Look at all these beautiful children who are female in the world. And in addition to all the other outrages which I've referred to in terms of children throughout the slums and the shanty towns of the third world, in addition to all the horrors that will be heaped on them, the actual living in garbage and human waste in the hundreds of millions as their fate laid out before them, yes, even before they are born, there is, on top of this, for those children who are born female, the horror of everything that this will bring simply because they are female in a world of male domination. And this is true not only in the third world, in modern countries like the U.S. as well. The statistics barely capture it. The millions who will be raped, the millions more who will be routinely demeaned, deceived, degraded, and all too often brutalized by those who are supposed to be their most intimate lovers. The way in which so many women will be shamed, hounded, and harassed if they seek to exercise reproductive rights through abortion or even birth control. The many who will be forced into prostitution and pornography, and all those who, if they do not have that particular fate, and even if they achieve some success in this new world where supposedly there are no barriers for women, will be surrounded on every side and insulted at every moment by a society and a culture which degrades women on the streets, in the schools and workplaces, in the home, and on a daily basis and in countless ways. What's that say? What's that mean to you? What's that say? What do you think of it?
I've had a lot of debate and talk about this, and because of the way society is implemented, that males are dominant over females. I know that even, you know, in the corporate world, like, we can't get ahead. A lot of women have degrees, master degrees, and, you know, are suited for these jobs, but just because they're female, they don't get them, you know. I have been raped as a child. Was told, you're a woman, you know, well, you will grow up to be a woman. This is part of life. You know, this is just what men do because they can. I've been in a very, very domestic situation with my first husband, you know, where just about every day, you know, I had black eyes and so forth, you know. I had to leave and go to shelters to see that me and my kids, you know, would live. The thought, you know, that men, you have a right to do this because of their masculine strength is just, it's unbelievable. And this is another thing, you know, that needs to be addressed. Because women, you know, we are women. We shouldn't be exploited and raped and beat and you know, just demoralized just because we're women. You know, there are a lot of very strong women, women that raise families on their own, you know, that are very productive, you know, in society, and they should be treated as such, you know, especially when you have a partner. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, and it's true, because we're born female, it's just, you know, you're a female, you do what I say, and I'm the man, and that's it. Yeah, yeah.
We talked about how horrible it is that women are often made to believe that whatever happens to them, whatever form of abuse they suffer, it's somehow their own fault. Nikki leaned forward and took her story to a place I didn't expect, a place of unimaginable horror and terror.
Mm-hmm. If you had, that dress is a little short. If you hadn't wore that dress, maybe you wouldn't have got raped. You know what I'm saying? I mean, we're not even allowed to wear the clothing that we want to. You know, it's always for some reason, it's always our fault. You know, like I said, my first husband and I, we met when I was 14 and he was 19. I was physically abused and raped by the time that I was 20 and I actually married him. God, don't even ask me why, but then is where, you know, I began to learn about the abuse, you know, that women have to take. And, you know, he would get drunk, and today I'd have a black eye, and tomorrow he'd be sorry, you know. And my kids were in turmoil. They were always shaking and nervous, not knowing what's going to happen today, what's going to happen tomorrow. You know, my daughter learned how to dial 911 in the dark by the time she was 5 years old. You know, I've been beaten with police rods. I've been stabbed. I mean, you name it. It's been done. You know, and this is why I fight as hard as I do. You know, no matter what has happened to me, I realize that I have to continue to fight so that this can change.
It took me a minute to gather myself up after hearing Nikki's story, and since she had ended this story with her determination to fight to change this inhuman world, I asked her what it meant to her
to have found this movement for revolution.
It meant, thank God, somebody else sees the vision that I have for changing what women go through, for changing the educational systems so that everything is equal when it comes to education, changing that some countries are starving and some that are not, just making changes to better human life, period. And that's how I felt. I've had this vision my whole life. There's really people out here that share my vision. And that's why it was like a godsend. Wow, God sent these people to me. Like, see, somebody else thinks what you think, you know. And that's why I'm just so happy to contribute, to do whatever I can to make this movement a success.
Now, I knew that Nikki had never heard of Bob Avakian or his work before meeting this tour, but I also knew how much she had gotten into the book Basics, especially in terms of learning the truth about the world and beginning to see how it can be and needs to be fundamentally changed. So I asked her what she thought about Bob Avakian and his revolutionary vision and work.
I think I've never met this man. I've just started reading his book, but I think that he is a leader. A leader is a person that has a vision and is so genuine in that vision that they're allowed to get other people to share that vision and to become a part of it. And in my opinion, he's a leader in a positive manner. You know, people say, oh, you know, communists or whatever. Listen, this man is teaching me things that I never knew before and is showing me a way to change the things that I feel that need to be changed, which is this whole world, by the way, you know. It's powerful stuff.
All right, you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. I want to thank my guest today, Roger Genver-Smith, playwright, actor, and writer, and the author of a new work called Rodney King. And I also want to thank Nikki from New York, and I want to thank her for sitting back and talking with me and sharing her life, her misery, her joy with me throughout the conversation there, and especially for the inspiration she brought to me when she talked about how important it was to her to find the work and vision of Bob Avakian, to find the book Basics, and especially to find that movement for revolution that holds a lot of hope for her. All right, so we'll be doing more on this series in the future, so stay tuned and keep following it. I'm sure you're really going to get a lot out of it yourselves. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with Revolution from Dr. John.